ASDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
In recent months, Iran has taken steps that it has never taken before, steps to weaponize this enriched uranium.
This hour, we assess the damage at Iran's nuclear facilities so far from Israeli airstrikes.
It's Friday, June 13th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. As immigration raids continue around the country, Catholic church attendance is falling in Nashville.
The mass at 10 a.m., it was kind of empty. And the mass service is always so full.
Also, 11 Democrats are competing to replace New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Early voting for the primary begins this weekend.
And a preview of the Club World Cup men's soccer tournament, which kicks off this Saturday.
For the first time in history, the 32 best clubs in the world will compete in a tournament to determine who is the best club in the world.
First, this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Iran has launched missiles against Israel, targeting populated areas across parts of the country. The attack was in response to ongoing strikes by Israel on Iran, including on nuclear facilities. More from NPR's Jackie Northam.
Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, warned after the Israeli strikes that killed senior Iranian military figures and did major damage to the Natanz nuclear site that Tehran would retaliate. Iran's Revolutionary Guard Corps said it hit dozens of targets in Israel, including military sites, with, quote, precision, claims that could not be verified. U.S. officials say American air defense systems are helping shoot down Iranian ballistic missiles. Israel's Defense Minister Israel Katz says in a statement that Iran had crossed a red line by targeting populated areas and that Iran would pay a heavy price for it. Jackie Northam, NPR News.
In Los Angeles, Marines are now on the streets. They are part of a contingent of 700 who've been sent to the city in the wake of protests against President Trump's crackdown on illegal immigration. Reporter Steve Futterman has more from L.A.
Marines are moving into positions protecting federal buildings, replacing California National Guard members who had been doing the job. Major General Scott Sherman says the Marines will be limited in what they can do.
I would like to emphasize that the soldiers will not participate in law enforcement activities. Rather, they'll be focused on protecting federal law enforcement personnel.
All the Marines have undergone specific training, including de-escalation techniques. The last time Marines had a visible role here in L.A. was during the 1992 riots following the acquittal of the officers who beat Rodney King. For NPR News, I'm Steve Futterman. In Los Angeles.
More than a month after one federal judge halted a portion of President Trump's executive order related to voting, a second judge has now ruled that even more of it needs to be put on pause. More from NPR's Miles Parks.
The decision from District Court Judge Denise Casper affirmed a pause on maybe the most controversial part of Trump's executive order on voting, the section that would force people to provide a document that proves their citizenship if they register to vote using the National Registration Form. That provision was blocked as part of a different lawsuit in April. But this injunction goes further. It also stops the government from enforcing a part of the order that sought to punish states that have forgiving rules about accepting mail ballots. Judge Casper noted in her order that the Constitution does not grant the president power over elections, instead giving that power to the states and to Congress. Miles Parks, NPR News, Washington.
Consumers were a bit more upbeat this month. It marks the first time in 6 months Americans' view of the economy has improved as inflation stayed relatively contained, and the Trump administration appears to have reached at least the framework of a China trade agreement. Still, stocks plunged on Wall Street, the Dow down 769 points today. This is NPR. It appears the Trump administration is now reaching into the Medicaid database as officials look at finding more immigrants in the U.S. illegally to deport. According to an internal memo and emails obtained by the Associated Press, Trump administration officials retrieved data this week for people living in California, Illinois, Washington State, and Washington, D.C. Those jurisdictions have programs that allow migrants in the U.S. illegally to enroll in relatively new Medicaid programs that pay for their expenses using only state or regional tax dollars. A judge in Maryland says jurors in Baltimore awarded too much money in the city's successful opioid lawsuit. Scott Miascioni with member station WYPR reports the ruling lowers payments to the city from drug distributors McKesson and Amerisource Bergen.
Baltimore City Circuit Judge Lawrence Fletcher Hill ruled that a jury awarded the city too much in liability and punitive damages for the role the two companies played in the opioid crisis. The judge is suggesting a payment of $52 million, down from the original $266 million. He also offered the city the option for a retrial. The jury found McKesson and Amerisource Bergen liable for their role in the opioid crisis in Baltimore last year. Baltimore had more overdoses than any major city in recent years and decided to sue the companies individually for damages rather than sign on to a global settlement. For NPR News, I'm Scott Massioni.
Facebook parent Meta says it's investing $14.3 billion in artificial intelligence company Scale and will recruit its CEO Alexander Wang to join a team the company says will be working on super intelligence technology. It comes amid a push by CEO Mark Zuckerberg to expand the AI space. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation. Established 100 years ago, the Kresge Foundation works to expand equity and opportunity in cities across America. A century of impact, a future of opportunity. More at Kresge.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. For a second day, Israeli aircraft pounded Iran. Their stated goal is to stop Iran's nuclear program, which had been accumulating large quantities of highly enriched uranium that could potentially be used for nuclear weapons. Joining us now to discuss the latest on these strikes is NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so just bring us up to speed here. What do we know about what's been happening so far?
Yeah, as this conflict goes into its second night, Iran appears to have just launched a series of ballistic missiles at Israel. Now, only a few have gotten through, but video does show several impacts in central Tel Aviv. Meanwhile, Israel has been hitting a wide variety of targets across Iran. They've struck air bases, they've hit missile bases, they've attacked the homes of high-level military officials and nuclear scientists. And in recent hours, we've just heard that they've struck two more facilities linked to Iran's nuclear program.
Yeah, say more about Iran's nuclear program, because it's at the very heart of this conflict, right? Like, what do we know about that program?
Yeah, this program's been around for a couple of decades, and most of it has been focused on enriching uranium. Uranium is used for nuclear fuel, but can also be used for nuclear weapons. Now, to do this enrichment, they built thousands of machines called centrifuges and put them at sites across Iran. Iran claims the program is peaceful, but they've not always been forthright about it. They've kept some sites secret until they were discovered by outsiders. Also, in the early 2000s, it's now widely acknowledged that Iran did have a nuclear weapons program. That program was abandoned. But last night, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu claimed that Iran had restarted its weapons work.
In recent months, Iran has taken steps that it has never taken before, steps to weaponize this enriched uranium.
Now, most observers agree Iran has accumulated enough enriched uranium for about 9 or 10 bombs, but there isn't yet public evidence that they were trying to actually build one, as Netanyahu claims.
And now Israel is attacking Iran's nuclear facilities. Do we know what Israel has been targeting specifically?
Yeah, there have been reports of attacks at two facilities, a laboratory complex near the city of Isfahan and a deeply buried enrichment facility at Fordow. The Isfahan facility, the Israeli Air Force says it struck some labs that could help weaponize uranium. Fordow is buried deep underground. Iran's Fars news agency reported explosions there, but it's unclear what's going on because it's unlikely even the heaviest Israeli bombs could do significant damage to that site.
Because it's so deeply buried, which raises the question, can Israel actually destroy Iran's nuclear program from the air?
Yeah, it's not like in the movies where you can drop a bomb down a shaft and it's all done. I spoke to Jeffrey Lewis, a professor at the Middlebury Institute of International Studies, and he's doubtful.
I think you can't bomb a nuclear program away. You can slow it down, you can make it harder, but at the end of the day, you have to get all the people, all the facilities, and then you have to keep doing it until the other side gets tired.
But, you know, Israel sure is trying its best. Satellite imagery of Iran's main nuclear facility at Natanz, which was bombed at the start of this conflict, showed damage to centrifuge buildings and power supplies, though, again, an underground section didn't appear to have been hit.
Well, up until just yesterday, there was talk of making a deal with Iran over its nuclear program. Any thoughts on whether that's even possible now?
President Trump certainly would like it to happen. He said on Truth Social, quote, Iran must make a deal. But Lewis is doubtful that Iran's going to have any interest in this after the war. In fact, he suspects it may do just the opposite and push Iran towards getting a weapon.
That is NPR's Jeff Brumfield. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you.
The Diocese of Nashville has taken the rare step of telling Catholics they do not have to attend Mass if they fear for their safety. That is in response to a series of ICE raids targeting immigrants in the city. Mariana Bacayao from member station WPLN in Nashville reports that choirs in the city's Spanish-speaking parishes have been quieter than usual.
The first Sunday Mass of Pope Leo's papacy was sparsely attended at Sagrado Corazon de Jesus Catholic Church in Nashville. As the white smoke billowed in Vatican City, immigration and customs enforcement agents were in the middle of a week-long raid on Nashville's immigrant corridor. Nearly 200 people were arrested and detained by ICE in the span of a few days.
Ever since then, we have a scared community.
That's Giselle Huerta, a parishioner at Sagrado. She says that the Sunday after the raids,
the Mass at 10 a.m., it was kind of empty. And the Mass service is always so full.
At the start of the year, President Trump ended the decades-long precedent of protecting churches and other sensitive locations from immigration enforcement actions. To date, there have been no arrests reported inside churches, but there have been arrests just outside of church buildings. Nearly a quarter of all Catholics in the U.S. are vulnerable to deportation or have a loved one who is, compared to 8% of Christians as a whole. That's according to a joint report from the U.S. Catholic Conference of Bishops and several evangelical groups. In response to the raids, the Diocese of Nashville has told its congregants they're not obligated to attend Mass on Sunday if doing so puts their safety at risk.
I've never, ever, ever in my life, I'm 24 years old, I've never ever seen that or ever heard of them ever doing that. And to have a Catholic church come out to say that is because they know that their community is hurting.
Rick Musacchio, executive director of the Tennessee Catholic Conference, said the message to Nashville congregants reaffirms existing church law. The Catholic Church already allows for parishioners to stay home from Mass for any reason that could put them in harm's way, like in the case of a natural disaster or icy roads.
They can make that decision for themselves that conditions are too dangerous to attend Mass on Sunday and instead have a private devotion or private attention to extra prayer or reading the scripture.
Church attendance initially rebounded after the raids, Musacchio says, but has gone back down again as Nashville sees more attention from federal immigration officials. Last week, the Catholic bishops of Tennessee said they're concerned about the lack of due process for those detained, which they say, quote, contributes to widespread fear, especially the fear of being detained while simply attending Mass. For NPR News, I'm Mariana Bacayao in Nashville.
Okay, this weekend, early voting begins in the Democratic mayoral primary for New York City, and the field is crowded. We've got 11 candidates hoping to replace the incumbent mayor, Eric Adams. It has been a fierce, contentious election season, and WNYC's Bridget Bergen has been following all of it. Hi, Bridget.
Hey, Elsa.
All right. So last night, seven, right, of these 11 candidates met in a final debate. And perhaps the most well-known among them is, of course, Andrew Cuomo, the former governor of New York, who resigned from office in 2021. Can you just start by telling us, how is Cuomo's campaign playing out so far?
Well, just to remind people, Governor Cuomo was facing multiple sexual harassment allegations. He denied wrongdoing, but apologized to anyone he may have offended. 3 years after that, the Justice Department reached a settlement with New York State, agreeing on a number of reforms after finding that Cuomo had subjected at least 13 female staffers to a sexually hostile work environment. Despite that, throughout this campaign, Cuomo has said it's his experience that makes him the right person to lead the city at this time. Cuomo served as the HUD secretary under President Bill Clinton, was the state attorney general, and then governor of New York. He says he's the Democrat that can stand up to President Trump and manage a crisis.
Okay, so if Cuomo is leading the pack right now, who's mounting the most serious challenge against him?
So his chief rival is Zoran Mamdani, a 33-year-old state legislator and Democratic socialist who would be the first Muslim and South Asian elected New York City mayor. In a debate just last night, Cuomo said Mamdani didn't have the experience to lead the city, and he said electing him would actually be dangerous.
Wait, so what kind of experience does Mamdani have? Like, how did he respond to Cuomo on that point?
So Mamdani was elected to the state assembly in 2021, representing a district in Queens. He says people can look at how he's built his really come from behind campaign for mayor with thousands of volunteers. He's been pitching popular ideas like fast free buses and freezing the rents for tenants in rent stabilized apartments. His campaign does have momentum, but he's also faced criticism over his views on Israel and previous support for reducing police funding. During the debate, the matter of experience really became a heated moment when Mamdani blasted Cuomo for the controversies he's faced as governor.
To Mr. Cuomo, I have never had to resign in disgrace. I have never cut Medicaid. I have never stolen hundreds of millions of dollars from the MTA. I have never hounded the 13 women who credibly accused me of sexual harassment. I have never sued for their gynecological records. And I have never done those things because I am not you.
Dang. Okay, What was Cuomo's response to that?
So he doubled down on Mamdani's inexperience.
He's accomplished nothing. Three bills are all he passed. He has the worst attendance record in the New York State Assembly. He has never held a real job. He has zero accomplishments.
I want to be very
clear.
And
now he thinks he's going to be ready to be mayor of the city of New York.
Okay, well, Bridget, I can't help but wonder, as we are talking about these two candidates dominating the primary, where is Mayor Eric Adams? Where is he in all of this?
Yeah, so he is running for re-election, just not as a Democrat. Earlier this year, he was facing federal corruption and bribery charges, but a federal judge dismissed the case, granting a controversial request from President Trump's Justice Department. Adams has said the case was getting in the way of his campaign, so the date after it was dropped, he announced he would skip the primary and run as an independent in November.
That is WNYC's Bridget Bergen. Thank you so much, Bridget.
Thank you.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Nature Conservancy, committed to the belief that nature is common ground for everyone and that protecting nature is vital to solving today's challenges. Learn more at nature.org/NPR. From Raymond James, a firm focused on transforming lives, businesses, and communities through tailored wealth management, banking, and capital market solutions. Disclosures at raymondjames.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Next year, the U.S. will host the bulk of the World Cup, the men's tournament. There is another major international soccer tournament kicking off tomorrow, Saturday, in Miami. This one involves club teams from around the globe and features some of the world's best players. They'll be competing for the FIFA Club World Cup. NPR's Rafael Nam is here with more. Hi there.
Hey, Mary Louise.
So I follow soccer pretty closely. I have not heard a lot about this tournament. What's it all about?
So it's essentially the turbocharged version of a tournament that's been around for around 20 years. There has been previous versions of the Club World Cup, but it used to be kind of low-key and a lot smaller. It was held in different countries like Japan or Saudi Arabia, and it was made up of the winners of the top regional championships around the world, around 6 or 7 of them, depending on the year. The winner of the Champions League in Europe, for example, or the winner of the Copa Libertadores in South America.
So it sounds like this time around it's going to look a little different?
Yeah, it's still a mix of continental champions, but there are now a lot more of them, including winners from recent years and others based on regional rankings. There are popular teams like Manchester City from England, Real Madrid from Spain, or River Plate in Argentina. But also others around the world that are not so well known, like Mamelodi Sundowns from South Africa or Ulsan from South Korea. In total, 32 teams playing a total of 63 games in 11 cities all across the United States. The opening game is tomorrow in Miami, like you said, Mary Louise, mm-hmm. with the final next month in MetLife Stadium in New Jersey. Here's how Gianni Infantino, the FIFA president, describes it.
Starting on the 14th of June, for the first time in history, the 32 best clubs in the world will compete in a tournament to determine finally who is the best club in the world.
The best club in the world. That sounds pretty good, right?
Yeah.
Except there's a lot of skepticism from fans who wonder, is FIFA really crowning the best in the world? Or just the best in this particular tournament?
Yeah, I mean, they're big teams. You just mentioned Man City, Real Madrid. Why has there not been very much buzz about this?
Well, there are several reasons for that. Because FIFA wants to make this more global, and because it needs to plan a tournament this size in advance, it has led to some high-profile absences. Football Club Barcelona, which just won the league in Spain, or Liverpool, which just won the Premier League. Another big issue here is that there are already so many popular soccer competitions around the world. The Premier League in England, for example. And then there's the Champions League in Europe. The list goes on. Can the Club World Cup be as competitive as those tournaments? FIFA believes so, and it has an ace up its sleeve. It's spending $1 billion to pay the participating teams, and the winner could receive more than $100 million.
Okay, I'll play. Put me in. What about fans? Are they excited about this tournament?
No, so far, no. Ticket sales have been sluggish. Controversially, FIFA implemented dynamic pricing for this tournament, uh-huh. and it's had to slash prices. And tickets are still available. On paper, it sounds great. Here's a chance to see Bayern Munich, this huge German team.
Yeah.
But the big question is, will people pay to see Bayern play Auckland City from New Zealand?
We will watch and see. Rafael Nam, thank you.
The internet often serves up a main character, someone or something that people online are obsessed with in a given week. And even if it's not on my radar, I know it's on Mia's. Mia Venkat is a producer here at All Things Considered, and she spends so much of her time online that I trust she'll keep me up to date. So, Mia, who's the main character this week?
Mr. Worldwide!
Mr. Worldwide! Pitbull!
Oh, you mean Pitbull, like the rapper, singer, hip-hop star?
Yeah, that's right. Guy. Pitbull is the main character this week because he's been on tour in Europe, and
it's not just him that's the main character. It's him and his fan base. And so, Ari, I have a question for you. When you think of Pitbull and what his fan base would be, what do you think these concerts look like? Who's making up the crowd?
Like a typical hip-hop crowd. I'm going to say, like, kind of like dudes 25 to 35, like multicultural, kind of like, you know, like anywhere near.
Wrong. So if you look at, like, an aerial shot of, like, the pit at Pitbull's concerts, it is a sea of young women fully dressed as Pitbull in bald caps, drawn on goatees, and, like, black suits. And they're just dancing.
So what's going on?
I think that something about Pitbull as an artist, like, people just find him very endearing. He seems like this, like, sweet guy. His music is all about, like, partying, having the time of your life.
This for everybody going through tough times. Believe me, been there, done that. But every day above ground is a great day. Remember that.
But also, like, you know, the dressing up in uniform as the artist or whatever is not new for concerts, right?
Yeah,
like,
cowboy hats for Cowboy Carter, Beyonce shows. We get, yeah.
Totally.
For sure.
Exactly. But I feel like for this one, it's so silly and so, like, emblematic of, like, what the culture is yearning for right now. Look up in the stars, a bird is a plane. Not just me and the damn thing
changed. Live in hotels, swing on planes. Blessed to say, money ain't a thing. You said it's mostly women. I don't want to get too deep into the gender politics here, but if I had to divide music artists into people with a mostly male or mostly female fan base, I would not guess that Pitbull's crowd would be mostly female.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right about that. And it's funny, I saw this, like, on one of the videos of these concerts in the comments on TikTok, someone was like, made a joke about how, oh, Pitbull must have made a wish to a genie for to have all of his fan base be beautiful women, and then the genie just had a sense of humor. But yeah, I think the other reason it's so compelling to me is because, like, Pitbull as an artist, I could see how an artist would be, like, I don't know, annoyed by this, or, like, you know, you're, this is, like, maybe thinking that it's making fun of them or whatever, but he's fully embraced that this is his audience and that this is what they want.
Has he talked about it?
Yeah, he actually this week did an interview with the BBC, and he talks about how this is an honor for him, and he calls them the Baldies. And there was a TikTok posted by user Lulu from his concert in London, and he explains why.
Because we
the bald eagles, because bald eagles soar high. He has a spirit. Maybe it's about, like, being free. And all these concerts do seem like a totally uninhibited, free experience for these women.
You know, I've heard drag queens say that putting on the wig and the gown and the makeup allows them to be unfiltered. And I wonder if this is the same thing, except it's a bald cap and a mustache on women.
I think that's right. I mean, this is not a typical concert going experience. And, like, if you watch these videos of these women in the audience, like,
no one's dressing up to look good.
Yeah, it's not like a feeling of, like, I gotta look sexy.
They're
dressing up
to look like Pitbull.
Yeah, exactly. They're like, I have one thing on the plan tonight, and it's having the time of my life. And I'm gonna do that wearing a bald hat with a goatee on with my girls and making friends with everyone else in the audience. I say y'all having a good time out there.
Would you ever?
Great question, Ari. I'm so happy you asked that. I had concert tickets to see Pitbull last year.
Wait, what?
And then I got asked to go to the Democratic National Convention with you, and so
no
I
way.
Had to miss it.
When you and I were in Chicago, you could have been wearing a bald cap and a mustache at a Pitbull concert.
Yeah, and, like, blah, blah, blah. It was an amazing career opportunity for me, but, like, at what cost, you know?
At what cost?
Life is not a waste of time, and time is not a waste of life, so let's stop wasting time, get wasted, and have the time of our lives.
NPR's Mia Venkat, who sadly missed the Pitbull show but is here to tell us about them with her main character of the week segment. Thank you, Mia.
You're welcome, Ari. Reporting live from the tallest building in Tokyo. Long way from them hallways. It was O's and
O's. They counted always. Real fast. This is NPR News.
Proposed cuts to Medicaid in President Trump's big tax bill could impact access to health care for millions of Americans. One place that could be hit especially hard, Kentucky.
There used to be tens of thousands of coal miners, and that number has struck to, you know, 2,500. And then in its place, and to some extent, is health care.
Two Kentucky Public Radio reporters share the latest on the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Since President Trump's return to the White House, there has been an 18% increase in people filing for Social Security.
We're worried that we're not going to get it. It's going to be taken away, so we better get it while we can.
That story after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. Countries across the Middle East are condemning Israel's overnight attack on Iran, which included some 200 fighter jets striking more than 100 targets. The attack killed top military commanders, nuclear scientists, and Iran says 4 children, among others. Iran launched drones at Israel in response. The Israeli ambassador to the U.S. says one person was killed, more than 30 injured. NPR's Aya Batraoui has more.
Saudi Arabia says its foreign minister told his Iranian counterpart in a call that the kingdom rejects the attack on Iran's sovereignty. During President Trump's first term in office, Gulf oil tankers and Saudi Arabia's biggest oil refinery were struck when tensions spiked with Iran. There are fears this wide-scale Israeli attack could spiral into all-out war, affecting the Gulf's economies and stability. Oman, which had been hosting talks between the Trump administration and Iran on its nuclear program, described Israel's attack as unjustifiable. Egypt, which has been trying to mediate an end to the war in Gaza, says Israel's attack threatens to plunge the entire region into widespread chaos. In Jordan, air raid sirens sounded as its air force intercepted Iranian drones in its airspace. Aya Batraoui, NPR News, Dubai.
In Los Angeles, 200 Marines are on the ground outside the Wilshire Federal Building, part of the 700 the Trump administration is sending to protect federal buildings, replacing California National Guard members who had been doing the job, deployed there after protests against immigration raids. NPR's Tom Bowman has more.
The Trump administration wants to greatly expand this effort. This is just the beginning. A memo obtained by NPR says the government is looking to call up some 20,000 Guard troops around the nation to go on things like night operations to detain migrants and also rural interdictions to go after migrants working in vineyards and farms.
NPR's Tom Bowman. The Marines have undergone specific training, including de-escalation techniques. This is NPR News. Global warming is making a lot of people rethink how we build our homes and communities. From member station KUNC, Ray Solomon reports it's also changing how we take them apart.
All the concrete, bricks, wood, and asphalt in our buildings, houses, roads, and bridges make up a big chunk of global greenhouse gas emissions. The growing deconstruction movement is trying to do better. Deconstruction contractor Anna Perks says her team doesn't just demolish old buildings, they take a systematic approach to unbuilding piece by piece.
Typically what happens is a bulldozer will come in, smash it all, it'll all get trashed. But deconstruction, we try to salvage and recycle as much as possible.
She says deconstruction is step one in the circular economy of construction materials. Harvesting lumber, say, from an old house rather than a forest, that saves the emissions it would take to make new materials from scratch. For NPR News, I'm Ray Solomon.
More than 1.1 million Anker power banks are being recalled after reports of some fires and explosions. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says the lithium batteries in the PowerCore 10,000 power banks can overheat. Anker says it got 19 reports of fires and explosions, including 2 minor burn injuries and 11 reports of property damage. The CPSC says these batteries have to be disposed in a special way, not thrown in the trash or in general recycling. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station And from BritBox, committed to shaking up people's watch list with British TV, including new original series like Ludwig, starring Peep Show's David Mitchell. Streaming now at BritBox.com/NPR. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners who support this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Ilse Chang in Culver City, California.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly in Washington. There's been a big uptick in Americans claiming their Social Security benefits this year, and especially among those in their early 60s and at higher incomes. NPR's Laurel Wamsley spoke to a few folks about what is driving their decision.
Here's a different type of Trump bump. From January to May, the number of Americans claiming Social Security benefits was nearly 18% higher than the same period last year. One group filing at much higher rates than before is 62-year-olds, the youngest age you can file. One of them is Bill Armstrong in Berthoud, Colorado.
I'm 62. Recently decided it was in my best interest to retire.
He had worked in IT as a government contractor, but work had dried up. And the political situation with federal jobs being cut was another factor.
With the election, I thought, you know, my career might be over as I know it. I'm battling cancer, I'm married with a spouse, I'm, you know, single income. And I decided, you know, I better get in the system before they move that age higher.
President Trump has said he won't touch Social Security, but that's not putting everyone's mind at ease. Armstrong says he knows plenty of other people making the same decision he did.
They call them entitlements, but, you know, we all paid into those things. In my case, you know, 42 years now.
That's how Social Security works. During your working years, you and your employer pay into the system as a payroll tax.
We're worried that we're not going to get it. It's going to be taken away, so we better get it while we can.
The Social Security Administration acknowledged those worries in a late March meeting that was posted on YouTube but later removed. In the video, Leland Dudek, who was then leading the agency, asked another official if he understood the uptick correctly, that it was partly seasonal, partly driven by a rule change affecting some people with pensions, and lastly,
fear-mongering has driven people to claim benefits earlier because they're afraid they're not going to claim benefits at all.
Yes, you're exactly right.
In a statement to NPR on Monday, the agency said the uptick is due to claims from people with pensions, retiring baby boomers, and people who have collected spousal benefits now applying on their own records. Karen McKay is 66 and lives in the Chicago suburbs. She says she moved up her timeline once Trump took office.
I was originally not going to claim until I was like 70. That was my goal, because then when you claim it at 70, you get, of course, more money.
You hit full retirement between 66 and 67. But the longer you wait to claim, the greater your monthly payment until you hit age 70. But McKay no longer wants to wait that long. Some of her calculus is rooted in her fears of the Trump administration. She worries about how the administration would respond to another pandemic, and worries that potential cuts to Medicaid will make it harder than it already is to see a doctor.
I know several people who died during the pandemic. Plus, I know people who are dying left and right of cancer, you know, around my age.
So she figures she might as well get her benefits now.
I really don't need the money, but I'll just put it in the bank.
But McKay knows that choice has financial repercussions. When you claim Social Security earlier, you get a lower benefit for the rest of your life.
I have a financial advisor, and he was always 70, 70, 70, would tell people. That's the best thing you could do is wait until you're 70. And I agree with him, but not now.
The decision of when to claim can be even more important for women, who tend to live longer than men. For every year you delay claiming, your monthly payment for life is 8% higher, notes Kathleen Romig, who directs Social Security and Disability Policy at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities.
So it's a very consequential decision. It can mean hundreds of dollars every month and many thousands of dollars over your lifetime.
So what about the concerns some people have that Social Security will go away? Romig says there's no question that Social Security will continue to exist.
It's in the law, and only an act of Congress can change that. And Congress would be foolish to try to take Social Security away at this point when it's so important in the fabric of American society.
Still, she gets why people are feeling anxious and are making this big financial decision now. But if you do decide to file and later regret it, you can withdraw your claim in the first 12 months. You'll just have to pay all the money back. Laurel Wamsley, NPR News, Washington.
A celebration of the 250th birthday of the Army, including a controversial military parade that President Trump has long wanted, will take over part of the nation's capital on Saturday. Jay Price of member station WUNC reports.
The president spoke at a kickoff 250th celebration earlier this week at Fort Bragg. That event offered some clues about what to expect in Washington. Flyovers of military aircraft, static displays of Army vehicles and weapon systems, and a blurring of the lines between the military and its civilian leaders as the president's speech repeatedly veered off into politics. The Army had long planned a Washington birthday event without a parade, but Trump, who tried to get one staged during his first administration, said he wanted it.
Saturday is going to be a big day. In Washington, D.C., you know, a lot of people said, we don't want to do that. I said, yeah, we do. We want to show off a little bit.
Trump said the United States should also celebrate its past victories like other nations do.
You know, recently, other countries celebrated the victory of World War I. France was celebrating, really. They were all celebrating. The only one that doesn't celebrate is the USA, and we're the ones that won the war. Without us, you'd all be speaking German right now.
And his birthday also happens to be Saturday. It won't be a small party.
We're preparing for an enormous turnout. Hundreds of thousands of attendees.
Matt McCool of the Secret Service's Washington Field Office led the security planning. More than 6,500 troops will be part of the event. The parade itself will include artillery pieces, rocket launchers, more than 24 tanks, and formations of soldiers in uniforms from different chapters of the Army's history. The flyovers will include modern and historic aircraft, and capping off the parade will be a jump by the Army's Golden Knights parachute team. Soldiers involved say they're excited to be part of such a high-profile celebration of their service branch.
I look at this as a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Sergeant First Class Joshua Evans is part of the parachute team.
How many people get to exit an aircraft over our national capital and then fly their parachute into a landing zone? With all eyes on you, you're the coolest thing that's happening right now. And then understanding the gravity of that situation and then going to work and performing for the American public.
After they reach the ground, one of his team is expected to present Trump with a folded American flag. The celebration will end with a fireworks display. Critics have called the parade too militaristic, the kind of thing dictators do, and objected to the cost, which could top $40 million. Practical objections include fears the tanks would damage the streets of the Capitol. Colonel Jess Curry of the Army Corps of Engineers said earlier this week that metal plates were being placed where the streets were most vulnerable, tank treads had been fitted with rubber pads, and the drivers were specially trained.
We're using an abundance of caution. We want to protect these streets. This is our capital city as well, so we're committed to ensuring that we minimize any possible damage.
Security officials also said they're keeping their eyes on protests like those in Los Angeles against immigration and customs enforcement roundups. At least 9 groups have applied for permits to demonstrate during the event. For NPR News, I'm Jay Price in Durham, North Carolina.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. The man who attacked people in Boulder, Colorado, 2 weeks ago with Molotov cocktails tried to buy a gun to use in that attack. He was not able to, and Colorado police alerted the Department of Homeland Security when his gun purchase was denied. But federal authorities apparently took no action. Colorado Public Radio's Allison Sherry reports.
Mohammed Suleiman told police he hated all Zionists and had been planning an attack for a year. He found a Boulder group online, which has conducted weekly marches since October to support Israeli hostages in Gaza. In November, he tried to buy a gun from a Colorado sporting goods store, but as an Egyptian national with no legal status, his purchase was denied. Earlier this month, when he attacked the marchers, he used homemade firebombs he learned to make online. A witness to the attack shared this cell phone video on YouTube.
Stay away! Stay away!
He's right there. He's throwing Molotov cocktails right there.
15 people were injured. 8 had to be hospitalized for burns. Soleiman was quickly taken into custody and faces felony charges, including for hate crimes. More than a week after the attack, Colorado Republican Congressman Gabe Evans faulted Colorado authorities for not telling federal law enforcement about the failed gun purchase.
I can't help but wonder if this attack might have been prevented had the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, which is who does the background checks for firearm purchases in Colorado, had they been able to flag that for one of the multiple different entities that have been set up to share that information and prevent something like this from happening.
But Evans was wrong. Rob Lowe is with the Colorado Bureau of Investigation.
Colorado's firearm background check system worked as designed when it comes to the actions of accused Boulder terrorism suspect Mohammed Sabri Soleiman.
Lowe says when anyone is denied a gun purchase, state and federal police are automatically notified electronically. When the would-be purchaser is an immigrant without legal status, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security is also notified.
If someone is trying to buy a gun and is turned down, it seems to me that that information should be available.
Chuck Wexler runs the D.C.-based Police Executive Research Forum, a police policy and research organization. He says local and federal police should be paying attention to people who try to buy guns and are denied. But he says because multiple people at various levels are notified, it's possible no one is stepping up.
As to whose responsibility that is, whether it's the ATF or whether it's local police, it's a good question.
Colorado's Bureau of Investigation says firearm purchase denials for immigrants without legal status are a small fraction of overall denials in the state. After he learned that state authorities did notify federal agencies about Soleiman's failed purchase months before the attack, Congressman Gabe Evans, who criticized the state, says he wasn't sure that notification was, quote, significant enough. The Department of Homeland Security did not respond to a request for an interview for the story or provide a statement. For NPR News, I'm Allison Sherry in Denver.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
We'll be right back.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. The Trump administration is using new tactics in its deportation campaign. One strategy involves making arrests at immigration courts. NPR's Jimena Bustillo has the story.
Vadim Bulati is a political asylee from Belarus. He traveled to the U.S. several years ago with his wife and three children. But his fourth and oldest son, who was 17 at the time, was the child of another marriage and had to stay behind.
And we ran away very quickly. We didn't have time. We would not have had time to even get permission to talk to his mother. It was very difficult.
His son Alexander eventually left Belarus on his own and made his way to Mexico. From there, he reached the U.S. border and requested asylum through an app formerly known as CBP-1. That was last spring. A year later, Alexander went to an immigration court with his father for his first appearance.
So his father told me, Melinda, I made a mistake.
That's Melinda Schmeichen, a lawyer for the Bulatis who was unable to be at court that day and told them to ask the judge for more time to bring a lawyer.
He said, I didn't do what you told me. The government attorney said that they would dismiss my son's case. That sounded like a good idea. We agreed for that to happen. And then as soon as we got out of the courtroom, the government arrested my son.
Alexander has now spent a few weeks in a detention center in Minnesota.
I understood the prosecutor's words as the termination of the case, and you can be free. But I did not expect that this would be a legal trap, a verbal trap.
He is one of over 100 people that immigration officers have arrested after the Department of Homeland Security attorneys dismissed their cases in immigration court. That's according to a count from the American Immigration Lawyers Association. Immigration and Customs Enforcement confirmed the new tactics to NPR. Laura Reese from the right-leaning Heritage Foundation says that helps the administration's strategy of mass deportations.
Immigration detention is a means towards removal, if that's the final order. And expedited removal is a shorter process than regular proceedings.
There is a nearly 4 million case backlog in immigration courts. The Trump administration is encouraging judges to move faster through that backlog. According to an email obtained by NPR, immigration judges have been encouraged to dismiss cases from the bench, knowing that immigrants may be immediately arrested. Veronica Cardenas, an immigration attorney, says the strategy has caught judges, attorneys, and immigrants by surprise.
It's caught a lot of people off guard because this used to be something that was positive, where a case was dismissed.
Cardenas, a former DHS attorney, said immigrants are put in a tough spot. If they don't show up to their scheduled court hearing, that is also an automatic order for removal.
And it makes everything so difficult. You can't outrun this administration.
Alexander's father says that they are glad they came to America, a country they believed welcomed immigrants with open arms.
Here we feel, or rather, we felt at home. And we took many things as an example for our family. For example, to smile at everyone when meeting them, to say hello.
The Bulatis are afraid of what could happen to their son if he returns to Belarus.
What's happening now, it scares us. You know, I ran away from one dictatorship, and I would not want another dictatorship to be in America.
His lawyer got Alexander's immigration case reopened in court. He will not be immediately deported, but he'll remain in detention, and his case resets to where it was on that day he was arrested. Jimena Bustillo, NPR News, Washington.
The NBA Finals are heating up with Oklahoma City and Indiana on the court tonight for Game 4 of their championship series. Meanwhile, the NBA's Basketball Africa League will crown its champion this weekend in Pretoria, South Africa. Teams from Angola and Libya are playing in the final game tomorrow. The league is now in its fifth year and catching on with fans, as Elliot Hannon reports from South Africa.
This is BL Semifinals, and the action starts now.
When the semifinals of the BAL tipped off this week, the showmanship around the game felt like an NBA arena. During player introductions, flames burst from beneath the scoreboard as teams from Libya and Angola limbered up. At halftime, acrobats cartwheeled across the floor, and as the game heats up in the second half, a dozen drummers pound away from the upper deck. This, of course, is what the NBA does best, and what it promised when it chose Africa as the home to its first league outside the US. Showmanship, but with local flair. Something that didn't just feel like an American knockoff, says Kita Matungulu, NBA Africa's Director of Basketball Operations.
You know, it comes with drum, fanfare, energy and passion, you know, typically an African style, you know. So it's basketball, but you can sense that this is a little bit, have its own feels, touch and smell.
To help create that culture on the court, the teams themselves are taken from existing national leagues across the continent. They are mostly made up of local players and others from across Africa. The league is organized differently than the NBA. In the BAL, teams qualify to compete in the three-month tournament in addition to their regular schedule. Since its start, teams from more than two dozen countries have competed. During that time, the play on the court has improved as the league has gotten more established. The level is now closer to the G League, the NBA's minor league. But while the on-the-court product is important, attracting new African fans requires more effort, says BAL President Amadou Gallo Fall.
Yes, we want to have the best basketball played on the court, but at the same time, there's an opportunity to showcase our music, our fashion, our culinary, and just young people from Africa.
The business of the BAL, however, remains a work in progress. The league has big-name investors like President Barack Obama and former NBA players. The BAL was valued at over $1 billion in 2021, but it's also losing millions each year. To be successful, the league needs to attract young Africans that may be more consumers of American pop culture than they are basketball fans. Fans like Lecho Honolo Mamambolo, a 29-year-old teacher from Pretoria, who's standing in the concourse taking selfies with friends in front of a BAL banner.
Not huge into American sports, but obviously following teams like the LA Lakers.
Mamambolo says he has never been to a game before, but likes what he sees from the BAL.
The way they infuse like African, like you see the guys playing drums outside and how like everything's going on. It's very cool in that sense. It is definitely a vibe. I'm having a great time.
Now that the NBA has been successful creating that BAL vibe, the next task is turning Mamambolo and his generation into fans. For NPR News, I'm Elliot Hannon in Pretoria.
Happy Friday from all of us at All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, dedicated to creating travel experiences for the thinking person with programs designed for cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Learn more at Viking.com. From American Jewish World Service, committed to the fight for human rights, supporting advocates and grassroots organizations worldwide working towards democracy, equity, and justice at ajws.org. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.